Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show,
the firearms for handguns will just be changing from state-led organisations that have those through the states and territories through to us as Commonwealth.
The Parliament continues to debate on post-Bondi gun reforms amid political backlash.
NZEA have told us that up to 2,000 people, which is it's a very big number, would be directly and indirectly impacted.
Earring Station in the Hunter Valley will continue operating until 2029. And later today,
I'm able to reach out to different people from all over Australia and get that support.
Scholarship supports Indigenous medical student pursuing rural mental health outreach. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. This week, Parliament has been active debating new laws deriving from the Bondi attacks. One of them is the gun laws introduced by Labor and supported by the Greens. The legislation aims to strengthen background checks for gun licences, raise important standards, and establish a national gun buyback scheme. The Nationals have accused Labor MP and former Olympic shooter Daniel Ripakoli of being a whipping boy for the Prime Minister over his support for federal gun law reform. Community Radio Network reporter Noah Saccombe started asking Mr. Ripakoli what he had to face this week.
Look, I've faced a lot over this over our proposal for the gun law changes, and there's a whole lot of BS out there, to be perfectly honest, and myths and things like that. We're working hard here to make sure that we're delivering the best legislation that we can with what we have here to deal with. And every law-abiding gun owner in this country wants to see and make sure that we don't have the wrong people getting firearms and tarnishing our fantastic brand and fantastic name that we all have as law-abiding firearms owners. So we're making sure that the right checks are done between the National Firearms Registry. We're bringing that on board and bringing that faster into the approach. We're working with the states and territories. And let me just be very clear here. With the states and territories, they're the ones that actually have the limits of how many firearms you have. They're the ones that do all that legislation on the types of firearms you can have there as well, and how that fits into the firearm categories and your licensing categories as well. They're the ones that do all that. Federally, we do not look after any of that at all. We look after importation of firearms. We look after that side of things. And there's a big myth going around that handgun shooters are finished, that there's no more handguns in this country. That is all BS. There is no truth to that whatsoever. The firearms for handguns will just be changing from state-led organisations that have those through the states and territories through to us as Commonwealth.
We've seen some criticism to your position, which is aligned with what the government's been saying and what we've heard from experts for the past few weeks. We've heard criticisms from Senator Ross Cadell pulling out some interesting stops and accusing you of letting down the people of the Hunter and being a lobbyist, I believe he said, for the Labor-Greens alliance, which was an interesting turn of phrase. How do you feel to that sort of response?
For Ross Cadell to say that I'm a lobbyist for the Labor Greens Alliance, he clearly doesn't know me whatsoever. So let's just put that straight out there. And didn't someone say to me when you walked in earlier, who's Ross Cadell? So yeah, I think that's a good point to put out there as well. Ross will come out and play this filthy politics. That's Ross's choice. And you know what? But I will stand above that, and I'll be better than that, because Ross will put out his fancy media statements bagging me out as much as he likes. But I'll raise above that and actually do the politics and do the hard work that we've got to have here and go and have the conversations with our ministers around what I know and what law-abiding firearms owners all know about and work with every day in what we do. I will go have those conversations for the farmers. I will go and have the conversations for the sports shooters. I will go and have the conversations for the hunters. I will go and have the conversations for people who use firearms for their day-to-day work, for pest control and things like that as well. All Ross will do is keep going on with his petty little media releases, bagging out others rather than going having the conversations with their ministers and with the department to see what they can change. I'll continue to keep working with industry to make sure that we are having the voices heard of law-abiding firearms owners.
Mm. And as a sports shooter, for those completely out of it like myself, what are the kind of protections in place for, I mean, especially post Port Arthur and when we're seeing these mass shootings very rarely, what's kind of the reaction from within the sports shooting community, as it were?
Everybody who owns firearms and has a firearms license is horrified by what happened. Horrified by what happened in Port Arthur, horrified by what happened at Bondi, horrified at what happens with any attack where there is a firearm, whether it's in this country or whether it's overseas. Because we hear some of the things that are happening in America, here are some of the things that are happening all over the rest of the world as well. Like, we are horrified by that because nobody wants to see firearms used in that way. We want to see them doing what we do for conservation, doing what we do for sports shooting, and doing what we do for hunting, and also making sure that we can have our lush farming areas as well free from pests.
That was member for Hunter Dan Rupacoli speaking with CRN's Noah Saccombe. This week, Origin Energy announced the Eriering Station in the Hunter Valley will continue operating until 2029 instead of August 2027. The extension is caused by a concern from the Australian Energy Market Operator, stating the energy grid is not ready and could cause more harm than good across New South Wales. Some businesses have welcomed the decisions, saying they need more time to transition into renewables. 2NURFM's news director Ian Crouch spoke with CEO of Business Hunter, Bob Howes, about this announcement.
So I think we're in this zone at the moment of a lot of uncertainty. The delivery of the renewables and at a scale and a cost and a whole bunch of other things that we had anticipated by now just hasn't happened. And I think we should be thankful that we've got capacity in Eriering to continue to cover part of that gap. And it's pleasing that they've been able to negotiate with them to get that extension to make sure that happens.
And obviously that provides very important certainty for our business community as well.
Yes. Businesses, we do hear a lot about household energy bills, but I make your hair curl on what some of the stories I can give you about business bills, and for them to be able to, get some certainty with their retailers and their suppliers to lock in contracts, knowing that Eriering is going to be there as a backup, is going to be important, I'm sure. But also for the businesses and the suppliers of around the Eriering station, the NZEA have told us that up to 2,000 people, which is a very big number, would be directly and indirectly impacted, gives them a bit more scope to plan their future beyond 2029 and not having to worry about it in the short term.
A lot's being talked about at the moment about renewables and how they may, in fact, play out in the energy grid, and particularly in terms of pricing. Are you pleased to see that Eriering is going to be hanging around for another couple of years? Do you think that'll have an impact for the positive on pricing?
Well, I think I'm hoping that it'll bring stability. What we're seeing at the moment is enormous amount of volatility. We already know that renewables at the tap, if you like, at the generation tap, are being produced at what cheaper than what non-renewables can do for us, but we're not seeing that in our bills. The transmission systems aren't in place. The delivery networks that are required need upgrading, and that's going to cost money. So at the moment, we're seeing bills go north instead of south, as what we've been told for so long would happen. It's just not happening. So this period is, we're going to be in a very, very, uncomfortable bump at the moment. And I think we're going to see the worst of it over the next 2 to 3 years. And having Eriering there as a backup to try and help smooth that out is going to be of enormous value when we look back at this in a few years' time.
All right, so the government now has a bit more breathing space to get renewables up and running, but still there's a bit of pressure on them to perform, isn't there?
We don't want anyone to take their foot off the pedal about to bring in renewables on stream. This should not be seen as an opportunity to relax. This should be seen as an opportunity to get on with the job in the basis of knowing there is some insurance and some reduction in risk in being able to do that. To make sure that we do get to the point that we were all hoping we'd be at by now, but we're not. So, it's very much an opportunity for us rather than something to sit back and relax and take our foot off the pedal.
On the plus side, good news for the workers at the Eraring Power Station and all those allied businesses. They've got some certainty for a couple of years and will help with their transition to wherever they go in terms of employment.
Yes, it gives them more thinking time. We already know that many of the businesses there, you know, that some are impacted, going to be impacted fairly acutely. You know, they rely a lot on their business for Eraring, others not so much, might only be 10 or 15% of their business, but gives those businesses more time to think about what those prospects are and what their alternatives might be as they seek to diversify away from trading with Eraring. That's got to be seen as a good thing too.
That about covers it for me. Anything else you'd like to add while I've got you here?
No, I think we've been pretty comprehensive there, Ian. If you're happy, I'm happy.
Excellent. Thanks, Bob, very much for your time.
All right, mate. Cheers.
You
Bye.
Too. Bye now. Bye.
That was CEO of Business Hunter, Bob Hawaii, speaking to 2NUR-FM's Ian Crouch. More boots on country are needed to address mental health issues in Indigenous communities. That's the goal of James Cook University medical student Miles McKenzie, who is studying in North Queensland with support from the Australia's Medical Association Indigenous Medical Scholarship. He hopes to become a psychiatrist who provides outreach services to rural and remote communities in North Queensland. He's told National Indigenous Radio Services reporter Mark Hides the scholarship has allowed him to pursue opportunities beyond the university's campus.
The biggest impact has been taking on opportunities to pursue different learning experiences than you'd usually get in medicine. So things that are outside of the classroom, like those remote and rural placements that I've been very fortunate to do, it's actually helping relieve a lot of the just little financial pressures that come with those sorts of placements, like can I afford the fuel or groceries and that while I'm there. So it means that when I'm on those remote placements, I can actually focus on getting embedded into the community, finding out what the community needs, and helping to start address those needs even as a student. So hopefully when I come back as a doctor in the near future, I can actually make a bit of a difference for those communities.
Has it opened doors for you in terms of Indigenous mentors in the medical sector and supporters?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the president of AMA gave me a personal phone number when I went to the conference. You know, I got to meet all these incredible doctors, some of which were of an Indigenous background themselves, some of which were from up my way that I hadn't even had the opportunity to meet before. So I still liaise with them every now and again just to, you know, have a chat, you know, if I'm having a bit of difficulty, you know, with some study-related stuff or a placement experience, I'm able to reach out to different people from all over Australia and get that support. That, to me, is perhaps the most important component of this scholarship, really, is that you've got both the support of the AMA and the members within that.
This year's applications close at the end of the month. What tips do you have for someone who's going to apply?
When it comes to applications for these types of scholarships, I think the most important thing is to share your story. Don't feel as though there is a right way to write an application for this Indigenous scholarship program. The AMA is really about supporting some of our most wonderful young students to pursue their passion and pursue their journey. And the only way they can see that is if you communicate your story effectively on paper. And that can obviously be really challenging, but the best way to do that is to just be upfront and genuine. Communicate that passion on the page. If something's emotive and bothers you, put it on the paper. That ultimately is what depicts who you are and why it is that you're studying medicine and why you want to be a doctor.
You've mentioned your remote stints that you've done and what you've got coming up. What gaps are you seeing between what's needed in Indigenous communities and the health system?
Look, one of the biggest gaps with a lot of the rural remote communities is just service availability to begin with. So, you know, our mob have some of the highest rates of conditions like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and then from my area of interest on the mental health side, we've got some of the highest rates of suicide and mental illness as well. And the biggest gap that we're seeing is just a lack of service availability in these communities. And then if there is a service, it fails quite often, unfortunately, to successfully integrate with the Aboriginal community. So what I mean by that is it turns into a case where there's a mainstream health service And then there's quite often separate community organisations as well. And they really need to work much harder towards integrating the community services and the leaders within those elders within communities to work within the health services and alongside our health services so that the issues in each individual community, because they are different, they can be addressed that way. But look, the biggest thing that we see ultimately is it comes down to the availability of doctors and health professionals in the communities working on the ground. You know, my area of interest is mental health, and for me it's an area that I'm pushing quite hard in, because mental health, we have the luxury of not really being overly resource dependent. So there's very little in the way of taking our mental health professionals into communities.
That's James Cook, University Medical Student Miles McKenzie, speaking with NIR's News Mark Hides. This year's application for Australia's Medical Association's Indigenous Medical Scholarship closes on January 31st. Australians are being encouraged to move to the country in a report from the Regional Australian Institute. The Beyond City Limits report shows over 80 professions are able to keep more of what they earn by working outside of major cities. However, there are exceptions. CRN's political reporter Noah Sacombe spoke with CEO of Regional Australian Institute, Liz Ritchie, about the data.
Well, the Regional Australia Institute is Australia's only dedicated think tank looking at issues impacting regional Australia. And for a long time, we have been what we call busting the myths that exist in this country about what happens in regional Australia. And so looking through the lens of employment is yet another area and field that we felt was important to shine a light on. And so in this report called Beyond City Limits, we once again bust those myths, which have assumed for a long period of time that if you live in a capital city, you will earn more money. And what our report has done in a beautiful way is to unlock that myth and to actually share knowledge that confirms that in more than 80 occupations across this country, you can have a premium on your earning capacity by living in and across regional Australia. And there are, of course, caveats to that. But what this does is further encourage decision makers, be they investors or our politicians who are making decisions about this nation, and those regionally curious people who are sitting in our capital cities. This gives them the information that they need to make a decision about the future.
What are the main industries that we do see this quite significant improvement in the regions?
The ones that you would expect to see are ever-present, certainly trades and occupations. Within that, technicians, machinery workers, these are the ones you'd expect to see there. So coming out of sort of mining, labouring, there's always been a premium. I think the ones that are perhaps more surprising and important to reference are those areas that are really high demand around childcare workers, education nurses and healthcare workers. I mean, we've known for a long time that the need is immense for these skills in regional Australia, but we probably haven't had this kind of in-depth data which says bring your skills and also while you're there, obtain a premium in your salary. It's a good news story for regional communities who have been calling out for these skills.
One of the interesting features of the data that we're seeing from this report when it comes to splitting the country into major cities, inner regional, outer regional, remote and very remote, that the median incomes, they dip down for the inner and outer regional and then they jump up quite a bit for remote. What are we saying is causing that dip down for the regional areas, and what does that data actually tell us?
So what it tells you is there's a livability premium. So if you're moving to a regional area, and Australians have a love affair with the coast, if you're moving to a coastal area with high amenity, then invariably you're not always going to see that income premium. So you're considered to be in a regional area that's got good amenity. Even our larger regional cities, you know, they've got that good amenity with the lower house prices. What happens when you head into rural and remote and, you know, and outer, as they're termed by the ABS, is that you then have to account for the fact that you don't have high levels of amenity. And so that income premium is what our employment market has done to date to try to compensate for that reduced amenity.
That was CEO of Regional Australia Institute, Liz Ritchie, speaking with CRN's political reporter, Noah Saccombe. Feral cats have been identified as culprits in the killing of reintroduced native species at the two South Australian conservation sites. A study by the researchers from the University of New South Wales and Adelaide University has used DNA testing to discover the feral cats are responsible for a vast number of native wildlife deaths. While experts say controlling the feral cat population is changing, research highlights a need for action. The Wire's Ryan Curley spoke with conservation biologist Professor Catherine Mosby for more.
So cats are found in every habitat across Australia, so they're really wide ranging. They eat a really wide variety of prey, so they eat mammals, reptiles, invertebrates, birds, pretty much anything. They're really skilled hunters and they didn't evolve with our native animals. So our native animals are not really designed to tolerate that type of predation. So they're quite naive to feral cats. So because of that, they exert this huge hunting pressure on our native wildlife. And they're partly responsible for the extinction of nearly 30 or over 30 species of mammals. They're responsible for threatening many more brought over here by Europeans. They are really causing a lot of extinction and decline in our native species.
The study done in South Australia, you touched on it there, all over Australia, so it would be pretty similar the whole way around.
That's right. Even in the harshest deserts, there'll be a feral cat. If I go right out into one of my study sites in the remote parts of South Australia and I go walking around, one of the first tracks I'll find on a sand dune will be a feral cat. South Australia's got a lot of feral cats, as well as the impacts of domestic cats as well.
Yes, well, that's one thing I was going to touch on with you. How different are the challenges between controlling domestic cats and feral cats? Because obviously domestic cats have owners.
I think the challenge with the domestic cats is getting people to keep their cats inside or contained and also de-sexed and not feeding strays. That's sort of the main issue there in the cities, and not doing trap, neuter, release and those sort of programs that have been shown not to work. And the issue with feral cats is about controlling them. We don't rehome feral cats. We usually euthanize them. There's just too many of them. So then it's about how we can develop control tools to better keep their numbers down and reduce their impacts.
Could you elaborate on some of those control tools? So does that loop back to the DNA testing used in the study?
So the study that we did was really about when we release animals that are threatened into the wild, we're trying to reintroduce them and bolster their populations. We find we're radio tracking them. They wear little collars that we can radio track them just to check on how they're doing, and we'll find them dead and we don't know what caused that death. And a lot of times people assume it was like maybe a disease or maybe they were starved to death or maybe it was a natural cause. And we actually swabbed the carcasses and for DNA and sent them off to get tested, and they came back with feral cat DNA on them, which meant that the cats had killed them. So I think it's an under-acknowledged cause of death of these animals. So even though we know feral cats cause damage, I think we're even underestimating the amount of damage that they do cause.
Now that's really been addressed further, that is a main cause. What are some possible future solutions we could find, like maybe genetic tools being developed?
So they have developed a poison bait that's specifically for cats, and it does work in some areas. So we do use 1080 poison for cats, but it doesn't work consistently. There are some tools like the Felix the grooming trap that's been designed that puts poison onto the fur of the cat and the cat licks it off. And that's, you know, obviously a better way of cats ingesting the poison because it doesn't rely on them being hungry, but we have to put them all through the landscape. So we're really trying to get more tools that are sort of broad scale. You can do things like keep the vegetation in good condition, like stop grazing by kangaroos and by sheep and cattle. And that creates this sort of complex vegetation structure, which makes it hard for cats to hunt. And that can reduce their impacts naturally. But then there's other tools on the horizon, like gene drive, which is genetically altering their genome so that they only produce males. And they're looking at using that for a range of feral and invasive species. But it's still a fair way off at this stage.
How would you like to see the governments possibly tackle this in the future?
So I think a lot more investment into biological control tools and genetic tools for a whole range of invasive species, not just cats, but also foxes and rabbits. Australia has so many invasive species and weeds. We have so many, and we just don't invest enough money in actual developing these broad-scale control tools like we did with the rabbit. So the rabbit calici virus was developed and brought into Australia, and that created this amazing opportunity for revegetation across vast parts of Australia and helped lead to re-establishment of a whole lot of native species. So that was great, but we're just not seeing that type of investment that is really needed in that space.
That was conservation biologist Professor Catherine Mosby speaking with the WISE Ryan Curley. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from stations across the country. With the great support from the Walkley Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headline across your community and Indigenous radio, at the same time on your local station. Check out all of our week's stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on social media. Just search The Wire Radio, all one word, on X, or on Facebook and Instagram at thewire-independentcurrentaffairs on radio around Australia. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the land where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shiku. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time with more stories on The Wire Weekly.